Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome to today's show. Well, we're going to kick off today with New York Times bestselling novelist Heather Gudenkauf. Her latest book has just been released. It's called These Hidden Things, and I'll introduce her in just a moment. Coming later in the show, we'll talk with the author of Snapshots, Kathy Sosnowski. I knew I was going to mess up name, is a Canadian woman who wanted nothing more than to be a mom. She shares her journey of healing after losing all four of her children and how she turned her grief into art and connection with others. It's an uplifting and inspiring story because at the end of it, she came out okay. And at 12:40, we'll talk with Eric Lamette, who's a child Alconfino, tells the true story of a Jewish boy and his mother in Mussolini's Italy. And Eric wants you to know this is not a Holocaust book. It's a book of love and hope and the importance of retaining humor during times of adversity. And Eric is now 80 years old, and I was looking at his website this morning, and he's got two more books planned. He's a busy boy. So we'll be talking with both of those guests later on. But first, I'm pleased to introduce and welcome to the show Heather Gudenkauf. She's, as I said, a New York Times bestseller, also on the USA Today bestselling list with The Weight of Silence. And she follows that phenomenally successful debut novel with These Things Hidden. It's a dramatic work, and she tells a story of three families united by a chilling secret. Welcome, Heather Gudenkauf.
Welcome. It's great to be here.
And glad to have you here, Heather. I wanted to begin by going back a little in your story, and I read that the first seeds of becoming a writer happened when you were very young and you used to climb into a toy box to read. Tell us a little about that, if you would.
Oh, sure. Yes. My first love is reading. When I was very young, my family lived on an Indian reservation in South Dakota, and I have five older brothers and sisters, and as you can imagine, things got pretty wild around our house, and some of my father's students, he was the counselor at the local high school, they built him this beautiful toy box that he brought home to us kids, and I used to pull out all the toys and crawl in there with a sleeping bag, a flashlight, and my books, and just while away the hours within the toy box reading.
That sounds like a fun thing. My father built us bunk beds when I had to share a room with my sister, which I was never very happy about. But he built us these great bunk beds, and it was like being in a ship's cabin. I was on the bottom one with a reading lamp and my little shelf of books, and I used to love to snuggle in there. And that was my escape, so I can understand that.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about this book, because your first novel, well, we should say, was hugely successful. It was your debut novel, and to hit both of the USA and the New York Times bestselling list, I mean, that did extraordinarily well. How did that feel for you as a first-time novelist?
Oh, it was amazing. The words are hard to describe how I felt about that. I'm just a regular person, a teacher from Iowa who thought one day that she would, you know, give her dream of writing a try, and I've had a great group of people supporting me and helping me on this journey. So it was just an amazing thing and great to share with everybody.
Now, was that the first manuscript you wrote, or like many writers, you know, we'll go through several manuscripts before they get one accepted and published? What was that journey like for you?
It was my first attempt at writing manuscripts. Yes. And I started the day after school, got out one year for summer break, and I wrote all summer long and put it away right before school started again that fall. I finished my first draft. And again, at winter break, I pulled it out and asked myself, what am I going to do with this now that I have it completed? And I decided to try and find a literary agent, and I was very fortunate to find a wonderful woman who loved the book and was very supportive, helped me get it into really good shape, and eventually led me to Mira Books, who decided to publish it.
And how long did that process take for you to get your first book published?
I wrote it the summer of 2005. It took about a year and a half to get it in really good shape, and then a year and a half afterwards to find a publisher. So about 3 years.
That's pretty good.
Absolutely. I'm very fortunate to have this team of people around me.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. Now, your second one, These Things Hidden, tell us a little bit about the story behind this.
It's the story of one little boy who is left at an Iowa safe haven site as an infant. And it's about the four women who come in and out of his life at some point and serve in some way as almost like a mother figure to them, to him. And it's the mystery surrounding his birth. And it's also the story of two sisters, Allison and Bryn Glenn. Allison, we learn at the beginning of the story, was her small town's golden girl. She was gifted academically and athletically. And we meet her as she's just getting released from prison, though, because of a terrible crime that she committed. And she's seeking her little sister, trying to find her and reconnect with her.
There's a lot going on, isn't there?
There is.
The relationships and, choices that people have made. And obviously those lead to consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Every move we make, there is a ripple effect. And sometimes those consequences can be far-reaching, as is found in this book.
Now, you mentioned that the story revolves around a little boy who's found at safe haven. For those who don't know, tell us, because I know you're a huge advocate of this, I think it's a law, it's actual law, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The safe haven laws really came about in 1999 in Texas. There was a baby who unfortunately was killed, and they named him Baby Moses, the people who recovered him. And there was a great, outcry about this, and a law was passed hoping to avoid future situations like this, where a woman, a mother, or a family member with the mother's permission can take the newborn baby to a safe place like a hospital or a fire station or another medical center or religious place. The laws vary from state to state. And drop the baby off there and not be fearful of being charged with child abandonment. And there are a variety of these laws across the United States. Most states do have some form of a safe haven law to protect newborn babies.
Yeah. There is controversy about this, though, isn't there? There are some people who think it encourages people just to abandon children. But, the way I look at it, it's better to have an abandoned child that's going to be taken care of than a child that is going to be born into a home where it's not wanted.
Yeah, I agree with you. The purpose of the laws is to protect our most vulnerable citizens, which are infants. And with that law, too, it does protect mothers. Every day we hear about young mothers or other people who are found, in situations where they find themselves not ready to care for a baby. Mm. And this can help in a desperate situation. It gives them an option to drop the baby off somewhere safe, anonymously if chosen, and give the baby a chance at, having a family that can care for him or her and take care of the baby properly.
Right. Now, tell us why you decided to write a story based around this. I mean, where was the idea, the concept, where did it originate for this?
Well, of course, in the news, there were lots of stories, a few years back about babies being abandoned. But really, it came to me, and I really seriously thought about writing about it, when I heard a news story on the radio about a foundling wheel, and that was a term I had never heard of before.
What was it? I'm sorry.
It was called a foundling wheel. Okay. And as I listened, I had the same reaction as what is that? And as I listened to the story, I learned that back in the 12th century, in Italy, in Rome, the Pope at the time was very disturbed because so many babies were being tossed into the Tiber River by their mothers. And he was trying to come up with a creative solution to help with this. So he ordered the construction of what he called foundling wheels, and they are turnstiles that were built into the convent, where a woman could anonymously and safely lay her child and turn the wheel so that the baby would end up safely within the walls of the convent where he or she could be taken care of. And that was really, you know, the basis, what really our earliest safe haven.
Interesting.
And I thought that was fascinating. And that, with some of the stories that I'd heard across the United States and in my own home state about children who are left to die or worse, and I thought it would be a really gripping story to write about.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk some more about the book and what went into producing this, because it's received a lot of acclaim. It's only been out less than a month, I think, but it's already been receiving a lot of acclaim. My guest is Heather Gudenkauf. Her website is heathergudenkauf.com, and Gudenkauf is spelled G-U-D-E-N-K-A-U-F. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, our special Valentine's show will focus on relationships. Great relationships begin with ourselves, says Marianne Camerato. And is there too much drama in your life? Well, Marlene Chisholm will share how to stop the drama and find peace and prosperity. Join us February 14th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for this special Valentine's show.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment with Heather Gudenkauf. Heather Gudenkauf. Her new book is called These Things Hidden. And her last book, her debut novel, hit both the New York Times and the USA bestselling list. And this one is receiving accolades. It just came out last month. Heather, I wanted to talk in this segment a little about the writing process and what that is like for you. Do you have a specific, do you have any rituals or a specific process that you engage in when you're writing?
You know, I'm a busy mom of three kids, and I also work full-time as an educator in our town. And so I really just write whenever I can. And I think just that's been really key for me, just to have the discipline to try and write every day. It isn't always at the same time or the same place. But just the fact that I get pen to paper or get on my keyboard every day makes a big difference for me.
Yeah. Now, you said in the beginning that this book is about, it centers around a young boy and four women. How do you develop good characters? What is the process like for you?
Well, you know, as a newer writer, I've really experimented with that in my novels and tried a couple different things. And I really find what works best for me is because I do write my novels, my first two anyway, from different perspectives. The different characters tell the story and carry the story on. That I need to really get into each character's head or brain. And so I I work on writing one character's point of view from beginning to the end throughout the whole story. And that's what I did with These Things Hidden. So, for example, the character of Allison, I really started at the beginning with her, told her whole story, then came back and told the story of the adoptive mother, Claire, and wove her story within that. It's almost like pieces of a puzzle.
Yeah. How did you keep all of that straight? I guess you'd have to just refer back to each point of view as you started piecing it all together.
Yes, and, you know, lots of reading and rereading and cross-checking. And, you know, I'm getting a little smarter about it now, and I have a big, display board at home right now where I have sticky notes with the different characters' names and their characteristics on the display board. So that helps me a lot, too.
Mm. John Grisham has often been quoted as saying that he read everything and still reads everything he can get his hands on, and it was the bad books that kept him going.
Yes.
During times like that. What kind of books and authors have influenced you?
Oh, I just love to read, and I like to read far and wide. I love mysteries. I love Elizabeth Berg and Anita Shreve are two of my favorites, along with Sandra Dallas and Louise Erdrich. I just really love books that really get into the characters and just telling a great story. I also love historical nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Love to read about history.
Interesting. Do you read critics' reviews?
I do. I, you know, once in a while I will check and see and, you know, hope that people are liking what I'm writing. And, you know, I've learned that oftentimes that isn't the case. There can be the case that someone doesn't care for your style or story, and I get this little pinched feeling inside and then realize, well, you know, some writing isn't for everybody. So I take it and I listen to it, I look at it, but I also move forward.
Yeah, and I think you always have to remember as well, some people just like to critique.
That's true. I found that too, yes.
What did they say? If those who can't do it, critique it. have you ever written yourself into a corner with either of your books as you're writing? I remember talking with Terry Brooks a long time ago, and he said that he got 400 and something pages into a book that his editor just threw it in the trash and he had to start all over.
I can honestly say I have done that. I've written myself into many corners, and you know what I found works for me is I take a break, I take a walk, and come back and just, that's the great thing about word processors and erasers. You can go back and fix it. So definitely lots of corners, but I also find that in writing myself into those corners, I often get different and better ideas because of it.
Mm. Where do your ideas come from? I know you talk, I think it was on your website, about, you know, writing being an isolating kind of occupation by necessity, really. But you also have to have this input of life. So where do your ideas come from?
You know, I was born with a hearing impairment. I'm profoundly deaf in my left ear, and I found growing up that I tended to sit back and watch and just kind of watch the world go by. And I think that really did help me as a writer, because I tend to sit back, take things in, and observe. And for me, that's been a very good thing and a very helpful thing. I listen to a lot of radio. I read a lot of newspapers. Just really try to find real life ideas, ordinary people put in, you know, different unusual circumstances, and how I imagine they might work themselves through that.
Yeah. Now, you said a couple of times that you've had a great team of supporters around you. What's the best and the worst career advice as far as being a writer that you've received?
Oh, wow. Well, write every day. That's been told to me many, many times. Great advice. Bad advice. I've been so fortunate that the people who surround me, you know, are looking out for me as a person, first of all. And as an author, I have a wonderful agent and a great team of editors and support from my publisher. So I guess, you know, I can't say that I've gotten bad advice in regard to writing. And I'm fortunate in that way.
Now, as I understand it, you're on your third novel now?
I am. I'm about 100 pages into my third novel.
And what is this one going to be about?
I can tell you a little bit. I'm a little hesitant to say too much because, of course, I'll write myself into a corner and have to change things. But it will be, involve the different points of view, which I really enjoy writing in that manner. And it will be about people put in unusual circumstances and regular people. It will have to do with a school and teachers and a community faced with a terrible event.
So lots of challenges, again, of the human spirit there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And relying on one another and, taking care of each other.
So as you write your third novel, do you approach this differently? Do you know stuff now that you wish you'd known when you were writing your first novel?
Yeah, I think we learn, as we do. And I definitely am getting smarter about my writing, I think, and know when to, to listen to those reviews or when to, take certain suggestions or when to trust my own instincts and go with what I believe. So definitely a learning process, and with every project and every story, I hope that I'm getting better.
Mm. Now, I'm sure, a lot of people say to me, I'm a writer, but I write nonfiction. And people, one of the biggest questions I'm always asked is, how do you get started? How do you find the time when somebody else has a different career? But you say here you have a teaching career, you're a busy mom, you're still writing. How do you find the time?
Yeah, I joke. Well, it's not really a joke, but I don't do laundry, I tell people. But that's really not true. But I enjoy it so much. It doesn't seem like work to me. It doesn't seem like a job. I enjoy writing, and I love teaching. I'm really fortunate to be able to do two things that I really love, and of course I love my family. So it's all about balance, and absolutely family comes first. And my two careers, I juggle and do my best to keep it balanced, and I have a great family who keeps me balanced, so that helps a lot too. I do a little bit every day, and I think that makes a big difference for writers. You don't have to and can't expect to get it written in a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I think, I know when I first started writing, I've always been a writer. I used to write when I was a kid, but there's always this tendency to think you have to sit down and write, 500 pages.
Exactly. You don't.
And that little bit every day or whatever time you can squeak out makes a huge difference.
It does. The pages add up quickly if you approach it in that manner, and it can be a paragraph a day, but eventually you'll have pages.
Yeah. What do you think is the most common myth? I know you do book signings. I've seen the lines at the bookstore, which is really good to see, people waiting to have their books autographed by you. What do you think is the biggest myth about being a writer?
I think I was surprised a little bit about, the process, and I didn't realize what an intricate long-term process writing is. I mean, I know it's the writing part, but the actual publishing part, there's, so much that goes into it that is behind the scenes, and that was amazing to me, the whole, the work on the cover and the editing and the marketing part of it. It's just an amazing business, and so many experts in so many areas. It's really interesting to learn about.
What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Heather?
Well, I would love for listeners to be able to give my books a try. And, my books do have a serious nature to them, but I always like to infuse the books with hope. And one of my favorite lines from my novel, These Things Hidden, the caretaker of the halfway house in the book tells Allison, one of the main characters, meet the world with hope in your heart. And that's what I, try to do every day. And I hope that's something that the readers take away from the novel.
I love that line. Say it again before you go.
Meet the world with hope in your heart.
There you go. That's a great way to end today's show.
And
listeners can find out more about you at your website, which is heathergudenkauf.com. Gudenkauf is GUDENKAUF. And I know that you do, you say on there that you will talk to book clubs, time permitting. Is that still something that you do?
Absolutely. I love to meet with book clubs. I love getting together with groups of people who love reading as much as I do. And well, because I'm a busy mom and I also work outside the home, I don't get to travel a whole lot, but it's wonderful with technology. I do a lot of book clubs by Skype now, which is the video conferencing. With all you need is a laptop computer.
Right, right. Well, super. I thank you so much for being with us, Heather, and taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today.
Well, it was wonderful to speak with you.
And we're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, we'll be have my next guest here, the author of Snapshots. You can find out more about Heather again at her website, heathergudenkopf.com. And her latest book is These Things Hidden. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
This is Kim Arellano. Join me on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock for Walk the Talk with Kim. We will focus on nonprofit and community organizations to strengthen our community through knowledge, leadership, and collaboration. We will challenge our listeners to walk the talk and take action to support the health and growth of our nonprofit community. You will be inspired with stories of triumph and lessons in leadership. So put on your walking shoes, grab your brain, and let's walk the talk with Kim. Every Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Kathy Sosnowski. She's written a book called Snapshots, a story of love, loss, and life. Kathy, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Vicki.
And, you know, it's every parent's nightmare that they may lose a child, and you ended up losing all of your children to either death or to drugs and the street. But this story is not just about loss. It's about hope, and it's about overcoming your grief. You turned your grief into art and created connection with others. Tell us a little bit about how this started for you, the book.
Well, if I can back up a bit, this is my real recent book, Snapshots, but I started writing after my 17-year-old son died suddenly in an accident. Before that, I was a teacher of literature at Langara College in Vancouver and never wrote myself. But when my son died, the morning after his death, what got me out of bed was two lines of poetry rattling around my head. I went to my desk, wrote them down, and the rest of the poem flowed. So the death of my son turned me into a poet, and I kept on writing that first year of grief. I wrote over 140 poems. 7 years later, I collected them, I should say, because I continued to write, so I had a lot to select from, and put them together in a book, Holding On, Poems for Alex. So poetry was therapy for me at first.
Why do you think poetry? What do you think was it that drove you to poetry?
Well, the rhythms were already in my head from teaching it for so many years. And Wordsworth, the romantic poet, says that in times of emotional stress, we naturally lapse into poetic rhythm. And I've observed that, even observing fights in beer parlors in my younger going into rhythm. He called poetry emotions recollected in tranquility. So the deep emotions somehow get the pen moving.
Mm. Interesting that you should talk about rhythm there, because I remember somebody several years ago who was going through a difficult time, and she'd been reaching out to various modalities to try and heal her grief, and found that drumming, which is rhythm, helped her incredibly. Yeah. So interesting you should say that about rhythm.
Or singing works for some people, or even just walking, which gives you a rhythm out in nature. Deep grief makes you feel so broken and separate from the world. And I think writing or art therapy of any kind brings you back into the world.
Yes, yeah. I don't want to dwell on the loss of your family, but I think it's important to tell readers you did lose a baby that when it was 6 months old. You lost your wonderful son, Alex, when he was 17. You then subsequently lost two children that you'd adopted to drugs and the street. What happened with them?
Well, we adopted them when they were 4 years old. The girl was four. The boy was six. They had the same mother who was a drug addict in Vancouver, and they'd been neglected and abused. Our son was 8 years old at that point, and I was too old to adopt a baby. And he wanted brothers and sisters. So we applied, and I think not that many people pick the form and say, we'll take siblings. So we got these two children and thought that we could heal their wounds and make them part of our family by loving. We felt both of us had good teaching jobs. We had a lot to offer. But they both, at the age of 14, or I should say each, at the age of 14, went to the street and drugs. I don't know if they never fully bonded with us. The girl, when she was older, when I asked her, I told her I was writing this book, Snapshot, and I was talking about her leaving our home from my point of view. And I said, you want to tell me your point of view now? Because we'd had a number of years since she'd left. And she said, I wanted to find what my mother loved more than me, which was heroin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was, my husband had a theory, too, that you know, one is always seeking one's lost mother.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, there's no one answer. There was an active drug scene in Vancouver, there still is, but somehow right at that point when they were teenagers, it was very popular to run downtown and panhandle, have a party in what's called a squat, any empty room they could find. And they just joined that culture and seemed quite happy in it. Well, they were damaging themselves, of course.
Right, right.
So, and they both ended up in jail, Michael for longer times than Tanya.
Right, so tell us how, because, I mean, this is an incredible loss to you and your husband, but the book Snapshots is not a sad book. I didn't find it sad at all. I mean, there are sad parts in it, but
yeah.
I mean, it is a story of love, loss, and life, and it's a story of hope. And you literally took snapshots of the family when you were growing up and wrote chapters about them.
Yeah.
What do you hope this will do for other people?
I hope people tell their stories to their intimate friends, or some are more open than others, but I'm hoping that it helps people realize that we're all humans with our feelings and our longings, and that they will tell their story. I give writing workshops now. I'm retired from college teaching, but I give writing as healing workshops to other bereaved parents. And usually we have a time limit of the workshop, so I concentrate on poetry. And I have people that come and say, well, I've never written a poem in my life. Or they've been given pretty journals by friends, but they can't bear to open them and write about their grief. So I'm hoping in reading my book it will make free people up to tell their story.
Right. Now, I want to let people know that you are the Regional Director of International Parent Bereavement Group called the Compassionate Friends.
Yeah.
And also, I want to let them know, because we're almost at the end of our segment, Kathy, that you are coming to Seattle. Tell us when.
That's Saturday, February 12th at 6:30. I'll be at Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park.
Okay, so say that again, please.
Saturday, February 12th at 6:30, and the bookstore is Third Place Books.
Okay.
In Lake Forest Park.
Okay.
I understand it's a beautiful bookstore.
It is. It's a lovely bookstore. It's a very popular bookstore.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going there. So I'll be doing a reading, and there'll be a question and answer period, and of course, books for sale.
Okay, super. And do you have a dedicated website for this?
Yes, book? It's www.kathysosnowski.com.
And
Kathy's with a C.
Kathy's with a C, and let's spell Sosnowski too, because that's an unusual name.
Sosnowski.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us today, Kathy, and I wish you well with your book signing and your reading. And listeners can find out more about you at kathysosnowski.com. And that was right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just want to double check there. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be here with Eric Lamette, my next guest. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
This is Alternative Talk, 1150. Got it? Cool.
Welcome back, everyone. I couldn't see if I had the thumbs up there or not. Eric, Eric Ryder, of course, I'm talking to right now. Okay, let's just forget that and move on. My next guest is also called Eric. His name is Eric Lamette, and he's written a book, a highly acclaimed book, which is called A Child Al Confino, The True Story of a Jewish Boy and His Mother in Mussolini's Italy. And he's a retired CEO. He's, I believe, 80 years young. And so let's bring him on. Eric Lamette, how are you?
I'm fine. And you pronounced both the first and the last name correctly. How do you like that? A double whammy.
There you go. With a little bit of coaching in the break there. So how are you today, Eric?
Every day, I'm terrific.
You're terrific.
I couldn't be better.
Well, that's what we love to hear. This is a very interesting book. Very intense book in that, I mean, it shares a lot of information about your childhood. You want people to know it's not a Holocaust book. It's a book about love and hope. Tell us a little bit in your own words, a couple of sentences, if you would, about what the book's about.
Can I take a minute and read to you just little snippets from the things I took off the internet where people have read the book and have left?
Well, I'd love to hear your take on what your story is, and then we can share some wish concessions.
Well, my
and
story
read
is one. It starts to begin. It starts at the when I was just about eight years old, 2 months short of 8 years, when the Nazis marched into Austria, and my family decided to leave. on the spur of the moment, and we left 5 days after the Anschluss, after the Germans walked in. We came to Italy because Italy, I found out subsequently, of course I didn't find out when I was 8 years old, Italy was the only country in Europe that issued visas to Jews who were being persecuted by the Nazis. And that's in spite or despite of the fact that Mussolini had already become Hitler's ally. A lot of people find that difficult to believe, but that it's true. And because of that, thousands of Jews actually were saved. We came to Italy. The story becomes a little bit muddy because I'm not sure as to why 6 or 7 months after that we sort of left Italy. And all I can say is my mother, in her wisdom, and she was one of the most unusual people you'd ever meet. And I am so happy and so proud of the fact that the story in the book, I was able to relate the story of my mother, because people have written to me and they said to me, one person in particular said to me, or wrote to me, I should say, the tribute to your mother that runs through the whole book is the finest homage to a mother that I have read.
I would agree with you. You call her Mutter. She was a central figure in your life.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about her strength, her resolve, and how she passed that on to you, because it is central to the book.
My mother was an absolutely incredible woman. I will just give you one example of what she did, and that should tell the audience everything about my mother. My mother, at the age of 65, my stepdad did not like living in the United States. He had trouble with the language. He had trouble adjusting to the culture. He was a college graduate. So they moved to Mexico, where they met up with a bunch of other European refugees there, and they found themselves very much at ease. My mother, at the age of 65, was induced by her friends, because she was an excellent baker, not only a cook, but a baker. She was induced to go into making pastries for restaurants. My father went out to sell samples. So at the age of 65, from her apartment, she started baking.
Amazing.
Two years later, she had a company that had over 200 employees working on that.
Yeah.
At 65 is when most people think of retiring.
It is.
Not to start a business.
It is.
And they sold pastries and bread and baked goods to the finest restaurants in Mexico and to each and every supermarket in Mexico City.
Mm.
So that gives you an idea of my mother.
Yeah.
My mother had not a sixth sense, she had a seventh sense. She was an unusual woman. She had a feeling that most people don't have. And it was her doing that prompted us to leave Vienna 5 days after the Nazis walked in. Unfortunately, we left all of our other relatives in Austria, and they all perished.
Well, you have experienced an incredible amount of loss, and you say in the book that you did lose your childhood, but you also describe that whole period when you were in Mussolini's Italy and when you were in internment as the greatest adventure. How so?
Well, you know, when you're 11, 12 years old, and you befriend soldiers and military personnel, that's an adventure for a boy. Maybe not for a girl, but for a boy it is.
Right.
Well, maybe things have changed because a lot of women are in the army now.
Mm.
And I felt that this was an adventure for me. I mean, I helped military cadets to dismantle their machine guns and to put it back together. And as a reward, the lieutenant who became my friend said to me, here's a clip, go shoot the machine gun. I mean, what could be more exciting for a 12-year-old boy than shooting a machine gun? I mean, I felt like I had conquered the world and I was untouchable.
Mm.
And I say in the book, I guess I must have acted like that too.
Now,
my mother didn't want to know about these things. I mean, she was not at all interested.
Yeah. Eric, I'm going to ask you, were you aware that you were confined in internment? Were you aware of that?
Well, we're aware. It's difficult to say. Later on, that confinement was called free internment. Why was it free? Because we lived a free life. Well, the only requirement was that we had to report to the police department twice a day, and all we had to do is go there and say, hi, and leave.
Right, right.
And sometimes it was the cleaning lady that accepted that. Hi, and never wrote anything down. And other than that, we were not allowed to leave the perimeter of the village. But other than that, there was no other... we lived like all the other Italians. Certainly, everything was rationed. We had ration cards like the Italians had. And we bought very little on those ration cards because very little was available at the end, toward the end of the war. So the fact that you had coupons didn't mean anything.
Mm. Now, as an adult, I know you've been back to the village where you were confined. What was that experience like for you?
Well, very moving, very, very moving. 2 years ago, I was invited back, and they gave me an honorary citizenship.
Oh, wow.
But it was a very moving experience. Also because of the fact I did not find the same village. Unfortunately, I did not find hardly any of the people that I knew. They had all passed on. It seemed that life expectancy in that village was fairly short. But the reason I say I did not find the village, for the people who will have a chance to read the book, as you know, there was no running water in any of the homes. There was only one castle, so to speak, that had running water. But every other home had no running water. Well, when you have no running water, there are a lot of things that go missing, such as a bathroom, a toilet, mm-hmm. a sink, mm-hmm. Etc. And we had our bathrooms, our toilets, were outhouses attached to the house. And instead of being out in an open field, they were attached to the house. But other than that, we had to live with the flies and the stink and the smell. And it was enough. But, you get used to things. When I tell people that I really never stepped under a shower for close to 3 years, especially when I talk to high school kids, they go, ooh, wow.
I make a point
of that because I try to impress these kids that those are not the important things in life. There are many more important things in life.
Like what? Tell us. Tell us what's important to you now.
Like eating, number one. That's important. But I always consider one of the most important things in life, there are two, basically, or maybe three. One is good health, family, and friends. And if you can show me somebody who has true friends, generally there are only two or three that you have in a lifetime, I will show you something. It was a very wealthy person.
That's very important to you, I know. You've got quite a large family yourself. I think I read you have 7 granddaughters, and they're the reason that you wanted to write this book. Why did you think it was...
Well, that's the reason I was suggested to write it. I never had intention of writing it. Somebody suggested that I should write it. They heard me speak about the subject, and they said, write the book. And I said, I am not a writer. I've never wrote a book in my life. And I said, well, write it for your kids. They don't care whether it's well-written or not. And by the way, to the 7 granddaughters, we have just added a great-granddaughter.
Oh, wow.
Okay. We it just seems between my wife and I, we only have girls. We don't have boys. Anyhow, we were at What's Important, and I think I mentioned that.
Yeah, I know as a child in the book, you didn't really understand how the Jewish underground worked and what was keeping you safe at that time. What have you learned about the strangers who helped keep you and your mother safe during that time?
Well, like everywhere else in the world, including in our beautiful country here, there are people who devote part of their life to helping others. Fortunately, in this country, they don't take any personal risks. Whereas at the time of the Nazi era, which started in 1933, people who were actually helpers were people who took risks. And they were not all Jewish. Some of them were Christians. There are examples of non-Jewish people throughout Europe who have actually, some of them have sacrificed their lives, and certainly most of them, if not all of them, actually put their life at risk. In Israel, the Yad Vashem, the avenue of the trees is called the avenue of the righteous Christians, I think it was called. And there are thousands and thousands of people who at that time risked their life to help people who were being persecuted by the Nazis. Mm. A lot of people don't know. It's true there were 6 million Jews who were murdered, but there were also millions of non-Jews who were murdered, either because they were handicapped, or because they weren't smart enough, or because the Germans didn't like the way they looked. There were about 2,500 Catholic priests that were killed by the Nazis. You know, we never talk about that.
Mm. What did your experience as a boy teach you about resilience in life? I know, I remember reading somewhere that you became a master of reinvention, and you've taken this tenacity with you through life. What did you learn about resilience during that time?
It's important to have a sense of humor.
Isn't
it? My mother said to people who asked, how do you survive? My mother said, you've got to keep a sense of humor. To give you an idea of my mother's sense of humor, for instance, I volunteered to work for a circus once. I was all about 10 years old. And what I loved the most were the wild animals, tigers and the lions. And I came home one day and I said, you know, my mother had this attitude always, or this feeling that she expressed to me. She always wished for my early death. You know, when she didn't like something that I did really, that was really bad, she wouldn't hit me or punish me. She would say, you really wish for my early death. And so one day I came home and I said, you know, Mommy, I would love to have a cub, a baby tiger. She says, oh, he can't kill me himself, so he's looking for help.
Well, she did have a good sense of humor, and that's shown throughout the book, I think, with both of you. I'm not sure if you're a little around this, but you're around 80 years young, as I understand it.
I'm sorry, what was
you're
that?
Around 80 years young, as I understand it.
I don't know. That's just what somebody tells me. I feel like I'm 40. So
well, I read that in the book. You still feel like you're 40, but you're
right.
80.
Well, yesterday I rode my bike for 12 miles.
You did?
I couldn't ride
my bike for 12 miles.
Well, it was very, very windy here. So I was hoping on the way back the wind would be from behind. No, it kept changing. It was always from the front.
Yeah,
so
I
did it in less than an hour. And today I played tennis for an hour and a half. So that tomorrow I'm going to have to go back riding the bike.
There you go. And I read that you have another two books, ideas floating around.
I'm working on other two books, yes. Can I just tell you, read to you just very few sentences?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I don't know these people. They wrote to Amazon and I picked it up. Amazing, gripping, unforgettable. What's the next one?
And we're talking about your book here. These are reviews about your book.
These are people who are talking about my book. I can't find any more. Wait a minute.
There's loads on there. I saw them.
Powerful and fascinating.
There you go.
It is a remarkable story of the resilience of the human spirit. Amazing, gripping, unforgettable. Heart-gripping account from the start. Very inspiring book. I mean, if people go on the internet, they just look for a child al confino, or maybe just my name, Eric Lamet.
And that's spelled L.
They'll find the book all over the place.
That's right. And Eric's name is spelled with a C, E-R-I-C. And
yep.
Lamet is spelled L-A-M-E-T. Eric Lamet, I thank you for being with us. We have to go now. Really appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I hope that the people in your area get the chance to read a book. I don't want to be mercenary, but really, it's worthwhile. I hope the libraries get it, and they'll be able to get it from the library.
There you go. Thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate
it.
And I have to say, I have to let our listeners know that I really enjoyed reading the introduction to the book as well, because I learned a lot about Mussolini's Italy from a historical perspective, because I knew very little about that. I want to thank everyone for being with us today. You can find out more about Eric Lamet's book. It's A Child al Confino. And I think he has a website. Yeah, his website is his name. So you can Google him and find out more about that. And we'll be back next week. If you've got questions on today's show, or you have difficulty finding any of our guests or more information, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email me at Vicky, V-I-C-K-I, at conversationslive.net. And if you have authors you'd like to hear on this show, please drop me a line. Let me know. We're happy to investigate that and see what we can do. Okay, we're out of here for this week. Thank you, Eric Ryder, for keeping us live today. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.